Hi and welcome back. This is Police Stories Podcast. This is episode 41. This is a series of short stories about my 28-year career in the UK Police Force. Hopefully you've been finding it interesting. Thanks for coming back, or welcome if this is your first time. Good downloads this week again, thank you. And a few people have been going onto YouTube as well, which is handy because, as I said, you can make comments or ask questions potentially if you have any. So, at this point, if you've been listening so far, you'd know where I'm at, but just a quick catch up if this is the first one you listen to. I've just transferred into the Met, the Metropolitan Police Force, the largest police force in the UK that covers central London, or in fact all of London. I've gone back on to uniform response, so I'm doing your sort of bog standard police work, if there is such a thing. Some people still perhaps look down at, uniform cops as being, bottom of the barrel, and why haven't they got promoted, and why haven't they done, this, that and everything else. But the reality is, as I've said many times, you can't get any more varied than that. So for me, there was a lot of sort of cultural differences. I'd come from a small force that had, sort of 3,000 cops in it, up to the Met, which is 46,000. Obviously, it's the big bad London, capital city of the UK, definitely has its issues, as all cities do throughout the world, no doubt. But the policing style was very different as well. And we talked briefly, I think, last week about how, my mindset had to change, and that we stopped a 14-year-old lad, carrying a loaded firearm, and it did open my eyes a bit to the fact that, you basically have to assume kind of everyone is carrying something bad and is out to hurt you, and that way, that's a starting point and you can come down from there once you're established. Hopefully that's not the case. And because people will always say, why do cops always assume the worst of people? Why do cops always think bad of people? The unfortunate fact is that, virtually all of your career you spend dealing with, probably 10% of the population, which are, out to get you and do bad things. It's actually quite rare for you to come across, decent people to a degree, because you're just dealing with this same small pool of people that cause you the same problems. And it's only when occasionally they dip into the outside world that, more regular members of the public get involved, particularly true of the sort of gang scene, which is a massive thing in London and something which wasn't really prevalent, or in fact present at all, actually, in the force I'd come from. But where I was working now in South London, there was probably 40-odd gangs. And these gangs were very much sort of postcode-based. The various beef, as they would call it, they had in, between themselves, both infighting and with other gangs, would be down to the controlling of the drugs trade. And quite often just a respect matter. You only had to have somebody from the wrong postcode area look at someone, with a sideways glance, and the fact that they'd been disrespected was enough for them to think it was quite legitimate to go and stab that person, which, having come from a smaller force, that was quite a culture shock and took a bit of, getting your head round. But fairly early on, I had a call to, and this was a change and not necessarily a bad one, had a call quite early on, in fact, probably within the first day or two of me arriving, to I think it was just a disturbance in the street, just two females causing disturbance, as basic as a call as it gets. And we turn up, and sure enough, there's two females, I think it was a male as well, involved in a what looked like a minor, sort of verbal argument in the street, nothing too heavy. And as we pulled up in the car, in fact we hadn't quite come to a stop, we were just pulling up in the car, one of the females pulled out from her waistband a really large kind of 12-inch long carving knife and proceeded to chase one of the other girls with it. So I'd not really come to a stop, and I remember that because my partner for the day had basically cracked the door open and had leapt out while the police car was still moving. I hadn't even had time to stop it, so I quickly brought it to a stop, and this woman with the knife disappeared off after this other woman straight into a sort of block of flats and out of view. So I put up on the radio, and you've got to be careful what you say here, because you start saying urgent assistance or need more units on the hurry up and that, you can give the wrong impression. You can get yourself a bit of a reputation for, panicking or sort of calling up for people when you don't necessarily need it. But so I just put out what I was seeing, basically. I just said, got a female with a large carving knife in the street, and that was all I put out, you know. And that way people can make up their own mind, well, hang on a sec, this guy probably needs some other people there. So then I was in hot pursuit of this female along with my pal, and we went into a typical sort of London flat that was set over about five floors typically, and we raced off up the stairs after this girl. And by the time we got to about the fifth floor, everyone was blowing, as you can imagine. It's a fair old run up all those stairs. And the knife had been dumped in the hallway just outside a flat, and we were able to pretty much put the door of the flat in. I think it was partially open anyway. And we'd had a good look at her, so we knew which one had the knife. So we managed to get hold of her and drag her back out. She was arrested for possession of this knife, and because we'd both seen her with it, she might have dumped it, you know, in the hallway, but it didn't mean that, you know, it didn't happen. And then you can start obviously gathering evidence in terms of getting your CCTV, finding other witnesses, etc. But she was handcuffed, we'd recovered the weapon, and we were walking back down the stairs with her. Now, the time it took for us to arrest her and get down to sort of street level again must have been 2 or 3 minutes, you know, it was no more. Now, in my force I'd come from, if I'd have put up for, you know, another unit or, you know, somebody with a knife, I probably would have got one, maybe two other cars, and the delay could have been, you know, anything from 5 minutes to an hour, depending on how lucky you were, or unlucky, as the case may be, as to where your sort of colleagues were. We came out onto the street to find what I thought was like a police roadshow. There was something like a dozen police cars out there, both marked cars, area cars, which we'll talk about in a minute because they're something slightly different to the Met. You know, unmarked cars, there was dog vans, there was TSG, which is the unkindly named Thick and Stupid group. They're the riot teams, basically, from the Met. You know, very, very fit guys and girls that are trained to the highest level in all the public order stuff, and they will be going to the really nasty, you know, riots and the sort of Cat A football matches, which we know are going to be a big problem with hooligans. But there was, yeah, so there was cars galore, there was unmarked, there was dog vans, there was two or three TSG vans, which each have kind of generally six cops and a sergeant in each one, you know. It was just, you know, ridiculous, but very welcoming, you know. And once everyone realised, you know, that we'd basically got the woman in custody and we recovered the knife and that was it, obviously they started standing down and making their way off. But I said to my colleague who I'd been with, you know, I cannot believe the response we've had. It's incredible. And he said, oh, yeah, you know, if you put up for another unit here, you're going to get a good response, you know, and you need it. And the only thing was, in some respects, it changed your policing for the worse, because back in my old force, you'd have been very mindful of, you know, your communication skills. And if you think you've got 20 minutes before the next backup, you know, cop arrives to help you, then you definitely have to use those power sort of communication skills to save yourself getting a kick in, quite frankly. But the thing was, in the Met, you knew that 2 minutes away, no matter where you were in London, there was going to be good backup. And certainly 5 minutes, there was going to be lots of people there. So the tendency was a little bit more there to say, just to call up on the radio, say, another unit, please, wherever you were, and then dive into this big, you know, fracas of a fight or whatever it was, thinking, I know that within 2 or 3 minutes, there'd be loads of cops here and they're all at my back, you know. So, yeah, it changed your policing style for the better. Well, I don't know. Maybe, maybe not. So that was quite an interesting change for me, for sure. And that was literally like day one or two. So I learned that there's a lot of cops there to come to your aid, which is good. And definitely, as we'll see, needed for sure. We carried on with, as you would expect, with a lot of stop searches, you know, sometimes controversial, but still a really good policing tool. I think it becomes more controversial because of the types of people it potentially targets, you know, and you'll always get a hard time. No matter who you stopped, they say, you're only stopping me because I'm black, white, young, old, fat, thin, you know, it doesn't matter what they were, that was the reason why you targeted them, and not the fact that there'd just been a robbery around the corner and they were the perfect description for it, you know. But have to get used to other things as well. So we talked about in the last episode about how you got to really watch people's hands, and people cannot have hands in pockets when they're talking to you. You either take hold of their wrists or you make sure they keep their hands out of pockets and in your vision at all times, so they can't, you know, grab anything without you realizing. But the other thing that I started finding, and it took, again, you know, sort of my new colleagues who'd experienced this to explain it to me, if you stop someone, you know, and you might find a weapon on them, it could be, you know, a knife, it could be a bat, it could be a machete, it could be whatever, you know, be amazed who'll have iron bars tucked down, you know, sort of things you wouldn't believe, but all sorts of weapons you'd expect. But they were very clearly weapons, you know, there's no doubt. Well, I started searching people and finding bike spokes on them. So, you know, the thin spokes that you get from the center of a bicycle wheel, you know, very, very thin pieces of metal, with sort of sharp ends either end. I started finding these on people, and I was saying to the guys I was working with, what is this all about? Why are they carrying bike spokes? And the thing was, they knew that if they got stopped searched with a big knife on them, you know, or some sort of obvious weapon, they were getting arrested, simple as that. But for a little while, it muddied the waters because we were finding bike spokes on them. And what they were doing is, rather than stab each other with knives, they were stabbing each other with bike spokes, but they knew that they had to aim these things in the side of each other's ribs, because then if they could puncture a lung, then they could cause you know, a big problem medically. I think it was called a pneumothorax, where basically one of the lungs collapses. And then what happens is you have to go off and have a really unpleasant procedure. And several times I sat in sort of A&Es looking after people that had been either stabbed or arrested or both. And one of their lungs had collapsed because they'd been stabbed with these bike spokes. And the way round it is they have to put a drain in. So they basically make an incision in the side of the rib cage. I probably should have put a warning before I started talking about this, by the way, but it's a bit late now. So make an incision in the side of the rib cage. And then they insert a chest drain into that, and it both drains fluid and also allows, I think it's the air to equalize between the lungs. Again, tell me if I've got that wrong, because I'm not a doctor. But that way, the lung can reinflate and it drains any fluid out of it. But it's a very, very painful procedure. And, you know, there was these people, and very quickly you get to know the sort of gang members and the gang leaders on your ground. You know, sometimes even by sort of first name terms, they'd know you. And you know, on the streets with their pals, of course, they're big men, they're tough, you know, nothing can touch them, and they're real hard men, you know. But when you've got them A&E by themselves, and you've got, you know, potentially a dainty little medical member of staff who's got a scalpel and is just making this what looks like quite a neat incision in their side, it's absolute agony for them, especially when they start inserting this, you know, I wouldn't say quite a piece of guttering, but you know, a quite a big tube in the in their side into their lung. And honestly, they were crying, asking for their mum, you know, screaming and all the rest of it, which you wouldn't mention again until you were on the street, and then they started mouthing off to you and telling you how they were going to do all sorts of unpleasant things to your family or whatever, and you'd be like, oh yeah, I remember you, that's right, I saw you at A&E the other week, didn't I? I remember you crying and asking for your mum. And of course, that always shut them up pretty quickly, but you had to learn how to deal with the gang types quite early on, because they would definitely try and intimidate you and sort of walk all over you if they could. Yeah, the gangs were a big issue. The other thing they had a lot was trophy dogs. So they had a lot of fighting dogs, particularly a type called canary dogs, which if you Google them, you'll see the horrible things. They're basically dogs with kind of muscles on their muscles. They're massive, massive dogs. They bred them to fight each other, to attack other gang members, and to generally be, you know, nasty things. Now, I love dogs. I've always had dogs throughout my life, but these things, you know, they were like dinosaurs, you know, they were horrible. They were great white sharks, you know, with tails. They were really nasty things. And quite regularly you get called to dog fights in parks and things, turn up and there'd be you know, seriously injured dogs there, or the dogs would be, you know, even worse, kind of set on cops that were arriving. The good thing is, some of the gases we use, not CS gas, that was generally ineffective against dogs, but when PAVA started getting an issue, which is pepper spray, I believe that was originally sort of developed in the US for animal control. So that worked very well on dogs, and if you had to, you could spray it in a dog's face and it would keep it away from you, because if these things got hold of you, you weren't just getting a little nip, you know, they were going to take chunks out of you and you were going to have stitches, you know, they could create some really nasty injuries. The other thing that we used to have to deal with dogs was if we were going on a warrant where we were putting a door in, we would quite often have a fire extinguisher from the car. And if it was the old CO2 type, where the CO2 type kind of takes the oxygen from the air, as well as obviously spraying quite a loud, you know, sort of very visual sort of spray of white, you know, vapor. And if you sprayed that in the dog's face that was about to attack you know, that quite often would make them think twice. Yeah, gangs, a big problem in London for sure. and one that I'd had no experience of. So we talked briefly earlier about area cars, also called RT cars, which means, I think, radio transmission cars, or maybe radio telephony. It's an old adage. So most UK forces basically have, you know, police cars with cops in them, and they're generally response cars. So people that have basic blue light training, they are the ones that respond out to the 999 calls. Well, the Met does a slightly different system, or certainly it did. Now, this may have changed because obviously I've been out a few years now, but at the time you had panda cars. And I don't know really why they were called panda cars, to be honest with you. There no doubt will be a reason. I think possibly because of the colouring of how they were painted to start with, sort of black and white, I think, originally. So it'd be a panda car, and that would be your very basic. Now, going way back, these were things like mini metros. If you Google a mini metro, you'll see it's a very unimpressive sort of little triangular shaped car. And yeah, that was a panda car. It was a basic car, and that was a car that somebody who had no blues and twos permits, who couldn't drive like emergency calls on it, well, it didn't stop them trying sometimes, but so they would take that out and they would do just a very basic, you know, sort of inquiries with no blue lights, and you're just going around getting statements and doing house-to-house inquiries. And generally the sort of newer cops would be in those. They would be doing some inquiries. Then the next step up was you had the response cars, like other forces. So they would be, you know, sort of probably a medium-sized saloon car, you know, a Vauxhall Astra or something like that, Ford Mondeo, something along those lines. And that would be to respond out to your general sort of 999 blue light calls. And then every area had an area car or an RT car. And I think the RT name came from, these were the first cars back in the sort of 50s or something to be fitted with actual police radios. You know, this is when police radios first came out in the UK. So they became radio telephony cars, something like that. So there was RT cars. RT cars are area cars. These were much more powerful cars. These were basically like traffic cars. So they'd be very high powered BMWs, or at one point they were like Vauxhall Amigas, something like that. Very fast cars. They were driven by advanced drivers only. So you had a very, very few amount of drivers on the sort of normal response team would be advanced drivers, and they were able to drive these RT cars or the area cars. And there was definitely a bit of kudos in driving them, because if there was a stabbing, a shooting, an armed robbery, an intruders on, so burglars breaking into a house, it would always be the area car that got sent first. So you knew if you were driving that area car, or if you were the passenger in that area car, you were going to get to go to all the sort of Gucci jobs. So there was a little bit of kudos. And in fact, when they handed out the postings at the beginning of the shift and said, how it worked when I was there was you had a 5-week posting, so you would be posted with the same crewmate for 5 weeks, and you'd be given a call sign, you'd be told what your car was, and maybe assigned to an area or something like that. But the probationers, the newer guys and girls that had maybe 2 or 3 years in, would always be very, very keen to get on as the operator, as it was called, on the RT car, because they knew they were going to get the good stuff. But to be honest with you, it was held back a little bit from them, and it was only given to them if they sort of proved their worth. You know, they had to be really a cut above, you know, as a probationer or a new cop to get in that position as an operator on the area car, because you were going to go to the more serious jobs and you were expected to be operating, you know, at the upper level. And certainly on the team I was on, there was probably 2 or 3 probationers that would consistently get put on it, because they were very good. They were thief takers. They were collar feelers, you know, they would be out, they'd be arresting people left, right and centre, all legally, you know. But whereas perhaps some lazier cops would not get so many arrests and they wouldn't take so many reports, these guys would be out there getting all the arrests, taking all the reports, offering up for anything. It didn't matter what it was or how bad the job was. They'd be like, yeah, I'll do that. And that got noticed. And they're, you know, their treat, if you like, their gift for doing that and for being busy, was that they went on the RT car. Well, when I arrived in the Met from my force, I was already an advanced driver, which was quite unusual. And I had to go off and do a check test initially with somebody local to see that, you know, if they thought I was up to the standard of an advanced car driver. So I went out for a very quick kind of 15-minute blue light run around the block, really, with one of the sort of guys that was also a driving instructor on the team. He had a look at me and said, yes, I'm happy. You know, you are an advanced driver, so... And he would write on my little sort of police driving permit that I was an area car driver. So quite early on, I was put on the area car, which was great for me. And then, as I say, it was really good because you not only did you get to go to the sort of the good jobs, if you like, but also you generally had very good people working with you. You know, they wouldn't put the Muppets on, you know, on the op as an operator on the area car. It just wouldn't happen. So you always had good people working with you, which was nice. So it was really good fun working the area car. The other thing is that don't forget every borough has an area car working on it. Sometimes, you know, two or three. Now, if there's a call, even if it's maybe geographically 5 miles away from you, you might find that all the area cars in the area will start going to it if it was worthy enough. You know, if it was, you know, a shooting or a stabbing or a car chase or something like that, you could easily have five or six area cars that within, say, 5 miles, all making for that same job. So it could be quite exciting stuff, you know, sort of razzing through, you know, central London rush hour traffic, trying to get there before everyone else did to pick up this, you know, this really good job. And it made for some quite fun days for sure. So yeah, it was very, very enjoyable getting put on that. And it did mean you went to, like I say, some of the better jobs. One job we got sent to on another day, and this was really unpleasant. And again, a little, now I will put in a warning here. This is, I'm going to talk about infant death here. So, you know, if you don't want to hear that, and I know not necessarily, you know, people do want to, but if you really don't want to hear about this, then now is the time to turn off, perhaps. We had a call to A&E, to a child who was very, very ill. He was young. He was only about 2 or 3 years old. And when we got there, we hadn't been there long before he died, basically, in A&E. And the parents were there. They were very, very sort of God-fearing, these parents. And the medical staff said that, you know, they'd put them in the family room and they were just, the last time they'd saw their, you know, they called him their baby, but he was 2 or 3 years old, a toddler. He had been very ill, but you know, as far as they were concerned, he was still alive. So they were going to go in and actually sort of give the death message with us there in the family room to this poor mum. And the lad had actually died from effectively diarrhea. And I didn't think you could die from that, but I think he'd had it so long, it had been so bad, that he just had no fluid left in him at all. I think that was what had happened. But regardless of what had happened, you know, obviously a really, really difficult thing to deal with. Now, this woman, they went in, and in the end, they said, look, you know, we've got to go and tell the dad, and he's somewhere else. Would you go and tell the mum? And we were well used to death messages, and we've talked about them before at length. But I said, yeah, you know, no problems. I'll go and do that. You know, it's probably your least favourite you know, job in the police, but we all know it has to be done. And I had at the time a child that wasn't much older myself, so I knew it was going to be particularly difficult. When I went in, mum seemed fairly calm and she was like, have you got any news, you know, about my boy? And I said, look, I have, I'm afraid, and it's not good news. Now, it seems harsh and it seems quick and it seems a bit brutal, but the key thing is you have to say the words that they are dead. You cannot say they've passed, they've gone to a better place, you know, they've crossed the rainbow bridge or whatever it is, because they just won't get it. And particularly sometimes with religious families, even more so, they can think you're referring to something else. So I had to say to her, look, there is no easy way for me to tell you this, but I'm afraid your boy has died. And she kind of looked at me. She was a big woman, very large build. And she kind of looked at me, and this is quite a small room, probably, I don't know, 10 by 10 or something like that feet. So really quite a small room, just with a small couple of chairs and maybe a sofa or something. And she turned her head. And it was like it was taking a second or two to sink in, of course, bearing in mind the sort of gravity of the news. And then she just screamed at the top of her voice, a shrill scream, and charged at the opposite wall, which was thankfully only about 10 feet away. And she ran as fast as she could and hit this wall full on with her face, which bounced her off it, and she fell on the floor at my feet. And before I could say anything, she was up again with surprising kind of speed and dexterity. Turned around and ran the same at the other wall, and she did this about 4 or 5 times before I could stop her. It was just horrendous, you know. And in the end, a couple of my colleagues had to come in, and we virtually had to restrain her because she was really going to hurt herself. As it was, I think she'd sort of cut her lip hitting the wall. And so we sat her down, and we said, "Look, you know, there's nothing. There's no easy way we can tell you this. There's nothing we can do to help you in this scenario? You know, but would you like to see him? Because the staff had already said, obviously, you know, she's going to want to go and see him. So we'd said, we'd take her through. So we took her through to where he was, and she spent some time, and she was doing a lot of praying over the body with him. And also then the husband came in and he was joining the praying. So we said, look, we're going to leave you to it. So we left them to it for kind of quite a while, maybe 20 minutes, half an hour. And then the staff said, look, we're going to need that room soon. And really, he unfortunately is going to have to go down to the mortuary. So we went in and we said, look, I appreciate, you know, you want to carry on praying, but we are going to have to move him away. And you've got to be so delicate in these situations. It's so difficult to deal with these things. We did the best we could. But the woman said to me quite calmly and very seriously, look, not to worry. We just need a little bit longer, another 10 minutes or so, and we'll be able to bring him back. And I kind of stopped and was like, sorry, bring him back? She was like, yeah, you know, we absolutely believe in the power of God. He will come back. We just need to pray hard enough. And the pair of them turned and carried on praying. So we went out the room again. I said to the medical staff, look, you know, they're really struggling with this, as you'd expect. Can we give them a few more minutes? Sure, yeah. So they had another, you know, 5 minutes or something. And I went back in. I said, look, I'm really sorry, but we're going to have to move him. And we just need another 5 minutes or so, 5 or 10 minutes, we'll be able to bring him back, no problems at all. And then we can all leave and we can forget all about this, you know. And you're saying, look, you know, I don't know how to break this to you. That isn't going to happen. There isn't going to be any forgetting about this. I'm sorry, but you are just not going to bring him back. And it was terrible, really. And eventually, and I'm really talking eventually, we're probably another hour before we managed to convince them to actually leave that room and for him to them to be taken off to the mortuary. So it was a terrible job, and I'd never quite seen a reaction like that to a death message. You know, I think we talked way back in very early episodes about death messages, you know, and all the different reactions, but that was probably the worst reaction I ever had to one. The other thing we had at the time was regularly, unfortunately, police cars were getting crashed. You can't really drive through sort of central London traffic at speeds and get away with it too long. So cars were getting crashed, and we were due to get a brand new BMW area car that was coming in. And in fact, just by pure fluke, I was the first person to drive it. Now, it came in and all the others were joking, oh, I bet you know, you'd like a good long run in that sort of thing to really, you know, see what it can do. But that didn't very often happen, you know, within the Met, because the blue light runs generally would be quite short. You know, they could be 5 or 10 minutes, and you know, they weren't fast roads. They're all 30 mile an hour roads, so you weren't going that quick anyway. But on this occasion, we had a female colleague whose husband was also a police officer, and he was going through a very nasty trial with a really, really well-known sort of South London crime family, if you like, which had involved a death. And as a result of that, he'd had some death messages and some death threats against him. So this colleague of mine was off duty, but she'd rung into the office, spoke to the inspector and said, look, you know there's threats against my other half, and there's three guys in a car I don't know, and they're hanging around outside my address. It might be nothing, but I'm really worried about them, you know. She thought she'd maybe recognise one of them, but she wasn't 100% sure. So the inspector came and saw me, and he said, you just got that new area car. I want you to grab so-and-so. And it was like one of the fairly new cops who was just in his probation, or just out of his probation, so maybe 2 years in. And he said, and you get down there as fast as you can. I want you to absolutely break every speed limit going and make the best time. And it's about an hour's drive from where we were. They were sending local cops as well, but they really wanted to make sure she had local support, bearing in mind the sort of potential gravity of this situation. So I said, yeah, sure. A little bit of me was kind of thinking, yes. But we got in this car and we went out the backyard, and we had a short drive, maybe 10 minutes or so across town on the blue lights, relatively slow speed because of traffic and what have you. And then we were onto the motorways, and then there was a motorway for about the next kind of 20 or 30 miles straight down south to where this colleague of ours lived. And I absolutely floored this thing. Now, I might be an advanced driver. I don't consider myself a particularly great driver. And the speed thing always worried me a little bit. I've got to be honest. You know, when the speeds are getting up, it pretty much doesn't matter what car you're in. Now, maybe it's changed now, but the cars we were driving at the time, as soon as you started going fairly quickly, they all felt a little bit twitchy, a little bit edgy to me. And on this occasion, this was a brand new BMW. So as the speed was increasing, I was really praying that, you know, everything had been put together properly on it, because the speed got up and got up, and magically, almost like a magic carpet ride, the traffic just stopped. The motorway was empty and there was nothing in front of us, so there was nothing to hold me back. So I absolutely floored this thing, and I had it up to about 140 145. We just touched 150, and I understand it was limited to 155 miles an hour, this thing. But the probationer next to me, I could see that his eyes were absolutely out on stalks. And afterwards, he said to me, I was absolutely terrified, you know, at the speeds we were doing. But he said, it's all right. I knew I was with, you know, an advanced driver, and there was nothing to worry about. What I didn't tell him was that I was probably more worried than him, because at those sort of speeds, at 150 mile an hour, everything happens very, very quickly. And it felt like we were on a knife edge. You know, it felt one tiny wrong move, or a car had suddenly appeared, you know, or a little bit of debris on the road or something like that, and we'd have lost it, you know. And if you'd lose it at that speed, then, you know, it would be a massive, probably fatal accident. So it was pretty scary for me as well, I can tell you. But I didn't let on, of course, to him. I just shrugged it off. It's like, well, area car drivers, and we do that all the time, you know, which was definitely not the case. So anyway, we got down to our colleague's house, and thankfully local cops had arrived, although not that long before us. And in fact, I'd made the hour's journey in about 35 minutes, which they couldn't quite believe when I told them on the radio that we were there. Yeah, got back, and luckily it was a false alert. You know, they'd these people, they'd stopped and spoken to them, and it turns out that they were actually viewing a house, you know, nearby to this colleague's house. Although they had come down from South London, so there was a chance that she was right and that she might have recognised one of these, because they'd come from the area we had just come from. But it just so happened that they were viewing a house, and although it sounds like a likely story, you know, it was thoroughly checked out and found to be genuine. So there was, you know, it was a false alarm, which was good, because there was no threat to our colleague. And also I'd got to, let's say, run the car in, shall we say. So that's about it for this week. Just a few little stories that I've thrown in, and a bit of cultural differences between the force I'd come from. And next week we'll move on to some other jobs, some perhaps heavier jobs, although I appreciate this week was pretty heavy with some of the stories there. But yeah, we'll get on to some other jobs next week. Hope it's still interesting to you. Hope you're still enjoying it, and keep coming back. Tell anyone you think might be interested. I'd appreciate it. Okay, take it easy, and I'll speak to you soon. Cheers, bye.